DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Hello and welcome to this edition of DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories from behind the headlines. I'm Kate Laycock. Coming up this week, Belfast, a city divided. We examine the sectarian hatred behind the riots. Then, as China promises to reform its notorious system of prison labour camps, we hear one survivor's story.
I have no choice because the Iron Gate was closed behind me. I was in the jail. I have no friends, no relative at all. Nobody could come up to me.
Also to come, Ghanaian refugees return to Libya and corruption in Kashmir. How one man took on the land mafia and won. All this coming up on Worldlink. You're listening to DW's Worldlink with me, Kate Laycock. Those sounds come from the northern Irish city of Belfast. And no, they weren't recorded during the 1980s. They were recorded this week. For well over a month now, ugly scenes familiar to anyone who lived through the turbulent period known as the Troubles have been playing out on the streets of Northern Ireland's largest city. This time, it's Protestant unionists who are literally up in arms, having attacked more than 50 police officers with bullets, petrol bombs and other explosives. So far, it's thought that the damage can be put at about 15 million euros. The rioters say that this violence and destruction is all about a flag. But as John Sepulvedo reports, these riots are about what's always stifled Belfast: identity, the past and the future.
This is the sound of present-day Belfast. At night, in the Protestant area of East Belfast, young men wearing hoodies fire homemade rockets and petrol bombs. They light garbage bins on fire. They attack police, they smash windows, they riot. And when the sun comes up, most of these young men have no job to go to and no school to attend. Their own future is uncertain, so many of them find a sense of identity in the past, at places like this.
Telling each decade of the stories, we'll have the boards here for the 70s.
This is a man named David. He's one of the caretakers of the Ulster Defence Association's History Museum. The UDA is a Protestant paramilitary group. David's a member. And in the small, office-sized museum, the history of Belfast's militant unionism is enshrined in glass. Their 30-year fight against Catholics, also called Republicans, framed and mounted for display. There's homemade machine guns and pictures of imprisoned unionists.
A lot of Republicans and Catholics were interned, but we were also interned as well, you know. So it's another side of the story that they give that they never tell you.
Now, what you just heard is known in Northern Ireland as whataboutery. It's like a child going, well, they did this, so I did that. Here it is again, whataboutery, as David points to other pictures of unionist prisoners.
You'll always hear about Republican hunger strikes. We actually had loyalists on hunger strike as well.
This whataboutery is omnipresent in sectarian Belfast. Whether it's in the staunchly Protestant or Catholic neighborhoods, there are murals memorializing victims of the Troubles. Each side blames the other for whatever the current problem is. Right now, Protestants blame Catholics for the Union Jack flag being taken down over City Hall. Somehow, that's supposed to justify the rioting.
Because they think now, why can't Protestants get away with it whenever Catholics could get away with it? They rioted, they got what they wanted, so why can't we not?
This is John. He's a young protester I met at the UDA History Museum.
What would you like to see the outcome be?
The flag be put up and peace be brought. And no need for all the fights in our own hometown, we reckon it.
Reckon your own town?
Yep.
If the flag doesn't go up, what do you think will happen?
It'll just get worse and worse. It'll turn out and it'll get worse and it'll keep on going. It's part of the culture, and it should never have been took down in the first place.
The flag is a symbol of unionism, and it's a symbol of a once-dominant Protestant class. A class that, according to the UK census, has been dwindling. Today, Northern Ireland is evenly split between Protestants and Catholics. Many hardline Protestants already believe they lost out during the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement. The absence of the flag over City Hall is just another reminder of the decline of their power.
No surrender!
that no-surrender attitude is making this a dangerous situation. Recently, Protestants have been trying to lure Catholics into street fights. Irish Republican leaders have told me there are strict orders for Catholics to stay out of the fray. Not because it's the right thing to do, but because Republicans believe these riots will help swing more members of the public towards their positions. The riots basically give Republicans an upper hand in the never-ending game of whataboutery. Older Protestants like David recognize this.
We don't want people on the streets with guns and petrol bombs and bricks and bottles because they're only wrecking our own areas. A lot of loyalists are saying we should go back to war because of dissidents. I mean, two nights ago there was dissidents caught with rockets in Londonderry ready to go and kill police officers. And some are saying now we should be striking back at the dissidents. But 30 years of war has proved the gun and the bomb doesn't work. It's all about talking.
Now, as many rioters seem stuck in a past where street fights during the Troubles were a way of life, there's a question whether the Belfast City Council lurched too quickly towards the future by voting to remove the flag.
The decision certainly didn't come out of nowhere. It was a long process working up to try and reach some sort of a compromise and, I guess, to take the heat out of the decision.
That's Belfast City Councillor Claire Hanna. She voted to remove the flag on most days. She said the idea was to open up City Hall to Catholic constituents who may resent the Union Jack while bringing Belfast policy in line with the rest of the United Kingdom. Hanna notes correctly that it took about a year to pass and that Unionist politicians actually worked with Hanna and others to make the rule.
I don't think anybody anticipated the trouble that we have seen for the last 6 weeks, but I guess from my party's perspective, we wanted to do all that we could to soften the blow.
Obviously, that didn't work. The Police Service of Northern Ireland says the flags have sparked some paramilitary leaders to go rogue, and that two commanders of the Ulster Volunteer Force are inciting the riots, as well as attacks on the homes of politicians, politicians such as Hanna. Her house was fired on.
I think the signal when those shots were fired at our house was, I guess it was shut up or it was leave. It was old-fashioned intimidation.
Hanna, like many other younger politicians, speaks of a shared future for Belfast. The limited flying of the flag, she says, is one more step towards that future. And she says there is no way that vote will be reversed.
Also, if politicians, after 6 weeks of intimidation and street protests that almost always spilled into violence, it would be a desperate message to send to democracy if we all walked back into the voting chamber and overturned our vote.
Still, there are desperate messages being sent. The riots show a Belfast divided between those bogged down in the past and those pushing forward to their vision of the future.
John Sepulvedo looking both back and forwards in Belfast there.
I love you so.
Now, Lao Gai, it's a Chinese word meaning reform through labour, now synonymous with a vast network of labour camps set up during the 1950s and 60s as places of punishment and political correction for those thought to be opposing Chairman Mao and his communist regime. It's estimated that over the past 50 years, more than 50 million people have been sent to Lao Gai camps in China, and human rights groups believe that hundreds of thousands of prisoners continue to languish in them today. There are, however, signs that that may change. In recent days, China has announced that it intends to reform its labour camp system, although just what those reforms will entail remains unclear. Earlier, I spoke on the line from Washington with Harry Wu, himself a Lao Gai survivor and a leading expert and campaigner on Chinese labour camps. Harry was arrested in 1960 at the age of 23 for having expressed opinions critical of the People's Republic. He was a student at the time, and it's a day he remembers all too well.
The classroom door was open, a police came in. And then the police announced that he represented the Beijing municipal government and say, Harry, you have to go with me to the re-education labor camps. The first night, at midnight, the warden wake me up and call me to the interrogation room. And in the room, I was squat down and the lights of face on my face. Then they asked me questions. First of all, what is your name, your birthday, your address? And then the warden said, yeah, you have been sentenced to life in re-education, so labor.
Life in a prison camp, Harry, that was your fate as you thought at the time. What did you feel when you found that out? Were you very frightened?
I have no choice because the iron gate was closed behind me. I was in the jail. Nothing.
And what was it like in that jail? You spent 19 years there.
I have no friends, no relative at all. Nobody could come up to me. Even I do not know that my mother was committing suicide. I was very hungry and nobody can walk, nobody can work. Everybody just like a crops sit on the floor and some of them die. I don't know exactly how many people. I lost my weight. I only have 80 pounds weight. Is waiting for the death because we don't have enough food. And many torture. They broken my arm, broken my back, many beating, whatever.
Well, Harry, you survived hunger, you survived hard labor, you survived loneliness, and you survived beatings. You were finally released in 1979 as a result of political changes after Mao Zedong died. But you continued to champion the cause of prisoners who remained in China's prison labor camp system. Tell me, how did the conditions of those prisoners change over the years? Somebody in a Chinese prison labor camp today, how did their conditions compare to with what you went through?
Without the torture, there's no labor camps. That is the Laogai systems.
The Laogai system is not yet a thing of history. It's happening right now. Rights groups estimate that hundreds of thousands of people are still imprisoned. Harry, do you think that given what the Chinese government has been saying about its intentions to reform the system, that the system might be abolished?
First of all, impossible for abolish. Secondly, what is the reform? We heard the reform many, many times, many, many ways, but finally, impossible.
I was talking to Harry Wu, former Laogai prisoner and campaigner, who, by the way, is campaigning for a Laogai museum to be opened in Beijing. Now, during the bloody civil war which raged in Libya between February and October 2011, images circulated around the world of black sub-Saharan Africans being brutally beaten and even killed on the assumption that anyone with black skin was a de facto supporter of Colonel Gaddafi. About a million foreign workers are thought to have fled the violence, but now it seems they're on their way back. Our story takes us to a small town in Ghana, which has long been a base for migration to Libya. And, despite the risk, many people there are taking to the road once again. Reporter Marine Olivesi has more.
In the back alley of Nkuranza's main boulevard, a gospel beat pulsates from a dingy bar called Tripoli Inn. 20 years ago, a local opened the saloon with money he had earned working in Libya's capital. But the bar's name soon took on a meaning of its own. Nkuranza and this tavern in particular turn into a national hub for those dreaming to emigrate to Libya. Here prospective migrants could get advice from experienced travelers, connect with smugglers and plot their next move.
Nice. Here is the station. Here is airport.
Kassim Zakari spent 3 years in Tripoli working as a mason. The 28-year-old managed to save part of his wage and used it to build a mobile phone shop in Nkuranza. Now he says he needs more money to put a roof on top of his store and to purchase mobile phones to sell. So Kassim has decided to head back to Libya, though he says he's not looking forward to going back.
The country is not good, but they have money. That's why you are going there. When you get money, you come back to Ghana.
Over the past 3 decades, tens of thousands of migrant workers from Nkohansa have been on a journey similar to Kasim's. Onabu Ajukum is the town's mayor.
Every single family in Nkohansa has got a relative who has been to Libya. Personally, I have more than 5 brothers who have traveled to Libya. I have cousins, nephews who have traveled to Libya. And this is a close family.
Ambitious youth saw Libya as a promised land and a possible springboard to Europe. Most traveled without passports, and some died making the journey. But locals say the majority became wealthier along the way. When the Libyan uprising kicked off last year, over 8,000 migrants flocked back to Nkohansa and nearby villages. 1 year on, most returnees are unemployed, and some have already ventured back to Libya. Isaac Khengpong is a car electrician who lost his business after a family feud with his brother. He headed to Libya this January, hoping to make enough money to get back on his feet. Isaac says things started well there. He quickly found work as a mason in the coastal town of Zawiya. Libya's construction industry, he says, is in dire need of manual labor, especially in towns battered by fierce fighting between rebels and loyalists during the uprising.
If someone sees you that you are doing this man's house, he will come and took your number. He will call you, please finish it early and come and do my work for me.
But not everyone in Libya extended the same welcome. Militiamen arrested Frimpong in early March as he was switching workplaces. He says he was stripped of his belongings, then transferred to a detention center in the town of Gerian in Libya's western mountains. Frimpong says hundreds of sub-Saharan Africans lingered in the makeshift jail. All were subject to daily harassment, and a few were even worse off. During his detention, he says he witnessed guards beating to death 3 fellow Ghanaians after they tried to escape.
They took a rope and hung them, their head down, beating them with their guns. Those boys were shouting for about 2 hours, then they stopped shouting. They were dead.
Frimpong was deported a few days after the incident. Back in Nkohansa, he shares this cautionary tale with locals yearning to depart, but the message is lost on many. Undeterred by warnings, about 12 migrants still take off every week. On a damp night, Eric John hurries towards Nkohansa's bus station, a backpack on his shoulder.
Leaving his relatives, his friends, but he has nothing to do here. That's why he's going back.
Does he have children?
1 man.
Yes, 2.
What did you tell them before you leave?
He told them they should pray for him.
John is to cross 5 countries, catch at least 7 bus connections, and skip a few pitfalls before reaching Tripoli in 2 weeks at best. Friends around him tell John they hope to see him soon again in Libya.
Marine Olivesi reporting from Ghana. We end this half of the show with a story which should give hope to anyone who has ever found themselves in the position of the little man taking on the forces of big business and vested interest. Our unlikely anti-corruption campaigner is a man from a small Kashmiri village which found itself in the grips of an unsavoury scheme to enrich local government officials and private business interests at the expense of the local residents. And it was all through the agency of a town planning scheme known as the Master Plan. Joanna Impey presents this report by Shawanaz Khan.
Set with gushing brooks in the lap of the Himalayas, it's no wonder that Pahalgam has become one of Kashmir's most popular tourist resorts. There is, however, a catch. Attracted by the region's natural beauty, tourism has now spawned an infrastructure development which is encroaching on the very landscape it's there to profit from. Literally translated, Pahalgam means the village of shepherds.
It says it, well, it says it was on well,
varia
time.
Riaz Ahmed Lone is a local resident of Manskam, a village in the Pahalgam Valley. A few years ago, Riaz was just another resident of Pahalgam, running a small guest house. Today, he's a local hero, having successfully fought off a planning scheme which threatened to dispossess residents of Pahalgam like him forever.
You see, chief town planner was Mir Nasim.
The chief town planner, Mir Nasim, had bought land in many places in Pahalgam. Sometimes he bought through his brother, sometimes through his employees. These lands, and the lands belonging to other influential people, were kept in construction permissible zones, while the existing villages were classed as green zones.
In other words, the government official in charge of town planning in the area had drawn up a master plan which would benefit influential hoteliers, builders and the planners themselves. In the meantime, most villagers found that their homes were now in designated green zones, making them technically illegal and preventing even the most minor of repairs. Riaz had been visiting town offices since 2000 to seek permission to build a small hotel in his village.
One day a clerk tells me that my land and the whole of the local area falls under the green belt and that no construction is permitted. I ask him, where will the residents go?
As he walks through the village, Riaz points out certain buildings.
Look at this hotel and the adjoining guest house. This whole plot was inherited by two brothers and one of them sold it and the buyer has built this hotel. The other brother converted his home into a guest house. Now, in the master plan, this hotel site is designated as a commercial site and the adjoining guest house is in a green zone, just because the hotel owner is a former bureaucrat and is influential.
Riaz started rallying people together against the plan. In 2008, the residents went to court. On their lawyer's advice, they first sought a halt to the unbridled commercial construction in the area, rather than challenge the master plan directly. Meanwhile, complaints of malpractice in drafting the master plan began to surface in a state vigilance organisation, a body meant to keep a check on corruption.
In Chanhanji, an area of untouched forest with no access road, Mir Nasim had bought land through proxies and sold it to a hotel group. It was designated a hotel site, and down the hill, the villages were designated green zones.
Encouraged by this and other proofs of malpractice, Riaz and his friends turned their attention to the master plan itself. By 2011, the evidence against the town planners was starting to pour in. In summer 2012, the plan was scrapped altogether. The fight, however, was not an easy one for Riaz. In 2010, when the court put a moratorium on any kind of construction in Pahalgam, he became the centre of attention, earning hostility, even among residents for whom he was fighting.
The moratorium made things difficult for everyone. No one was allowed to even make minor repairs to their house. The officials and the land mafia instigated people against me.
Briefly, Riaz even had to run away from home to escape the hostile residents.
I kept fighting because I knew ultimately truth has to prevail.
Riaz's struggle paid off when the government was forced to draft a new master plan. This time, Riaz is hopeful that his concerns will be addressed. Meanwhile, he and his neighbours still have to wait before they can build new houses, but most of them are content in the knowledge that the future of their community has been secured, at least for the time being.
Shawana's Khan's report was presented by Joanna Impey. Riaz may have been able to fight off the local land mafia, but we, unfortunately, can't fight off the clock. Join me, Kate Laycock, after this break.
Change is taking the face off.
This is DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories from behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Kate Laycock. Now, changes and transformation. That's going to be our theme for the next half hour or so, assuming, of course, that nothing happens to change that. Our cast of characters is as colourful and eclectic as they come, with a French gargantuan of the cinematic screen, an Orthodox Jew who was, and perhaps in some way still is, a Shia Muslim, a singing transgender priest, and this guy.
Come on, ladies, 1 pound fish, come on, ladies, come on. Ladies.
More from the 1 pound fish man later. First up, though, that French cinematic gargantuan I mentioned. It can only be one man, really. Gérard Depardieu. The actor is one of the most recognisable of French personalities, both on and off screen. He's also one of the few French actors to have made it big in Hollywood, having won the Golden Globe for Best Actor for his stint in Green Card and having been nominated for an Academy Award for the title role in Cyrano de Bergerac. Already notorious for his tumultuous and often binge-fueled private life, Depardieu has been making headlines again this week after he accepted Russian citizenship following a heated row over French President François Hollande's decision to introduce a new 75% tax rate for the mega-rich. So, how are Depardieu's antics going down in his former home country, France, and his new adoptive home, Russia? In the interests of alliteration, we sent John Laurenson to Marseille and Gertrud Korkamp to Moscow to test the waters with the cinema-going public. Here's John first.
So tell me, what do you think of Gérard Depardieu?
I think he's a clever boy, a clever man, and I can't believe that he doesn't know what he's doing.
Wonderful actor.
And the rest.
It's sad. It's sad for him because I can't understand. He doesn't realize what the people can think about his doing. He got so much money. What's important to pay more or less taxes when you have so much money?
Are you talking about his lately?
What do you think of that? What do you think of the idea of his taking this Russian nationality, wanting Belgian nationality as well?
I think. He has the right to do it because in French, taxes are very expensive.
Very high, yes.
Very high, and maybe it's a signal for the government to reconsider their laws.
C'est super. Merci beaucoup.
So that was our random and very unscientific sample of French reactions. But what about Russia? Is Depardieu receiving a hero's welcome there? Here's Gert to tell us.
What do you think about Gérard Depardieu? Что вы думаете про Gérard Depardieu?
Думаю, что хороший актер. Ну, лично не знакома, но видела фильмы его.
She says, I like Depardieu as an actor. He's a very good actor. I like him very much. But the fact that he got a Russian passport, well, I don't think it's really fair. Что вы думаете про Жерар Депардье?
Ой, вы знаете, он взрослый человек, пусть там решает сам. Ничего такого нет. Я к нему очень хорошо отношусь.
And she says, well, whatever he does with his passport and citizenship, that's up to him. I don't really have an opinion about that, but he's a very good actor, and that's how I know him. Что вы думаете про Жерар Депардье, актера?
Ну, уважаем, мы очень нравится.
I have liked him all my life, he says. I especially like him in the comedies where he plays together with Pierre Richard. And I also like it very much that he now has a Russian passport. But is he now a Russian actor for you or a French actor?
Вы считаете его французским или российским актером теперь?
Ну, он, конечно, французский актер, но в России его очень любят.
Well, of course, it's Constantine. He's a French actor, first of all. But in Russia, people really do love him. And I'm not even sure where they love him more, in Russia or in France.
Well, those were the cinema punters, but what do our intrepid reporters make of it all themselves? Earlier, I got Gert and John together on the line to find out. I began by asking John to sketch out for us some of the previous headline-grabbing antics in which France's most famous actor has been embroiled.
Well, you know what? I think the first thing you want to understand about Gérard Depardieu is where he comes from. Because he's from a big, poor family in Châteauroux in the centre of France. And when he was growing up there, he He was spending loads of time on the streets, very little at school. He left school when he was 13. He got into petty crime, he got into stealing, he was already drinking, he was doing black market dealing with a GI at the nearby US Army base. Still today, he gets drunk, he falls off his scooter all the time, he's wanted in Paris on another drunk driving charge. He peed into a bottle in a plane when the hostess wouldn't let him use the toilet. He headbutts paparazzi photographers. He's the kind of person that people, when they're trying to be nice, they describe as larger than life. He really is larger than life.
Physically, as well as in terms of character.
He's become enormous, though, hasn't he? I mean, he barely needs any padding now to do the obelisk role.
Let's talk quickly about the reasons for Depardieu's decision to take Russian citizenship, because much as the Russians, I'm sure, would like to think that it's about embracing Russian culture, really, John, tax is at the bottom of this, isn't it?
Well, he says he's paid 145 million euros in tax since he started working about 45 years ago. And that's a hell of a lot of money, isn't it? And I think there are a lot of people in France sympathise with him. And I think this doesn't look terribly good for the government, which is why I think they've started to go very quiet on the Depardieu case.
And what about in Russia, Gert, the idea that a massive star of French cinema would come to Russia because he would be paying less tax? How does this go down?
I think in general in Russia people understand that what Depardieu has done is maybe not so much to get out of paying tax in France, because Depardieu himself said, well, if I had wanted to do that, I could have moved to Belgium a long time ago, like many people, rich people in France do, but I've never done that. I think that the general feeling here is that it was just a sort of a stunt, an attempt by Depardieu to make a fool of the French government and to make a statement, so to speak. And that's why he was so happy to be led around in Russia. He went to see Putin, he got the passport, showed it on television. He was taken to this Russian region of Mordovia, which has a very, very bad reputation. I think Depardieu will understand that now, because it's a region with a lot of labor camps already since Stalin's era and now as well.
He's been praising Russian democracy.
Yeah, well, that's all very bizarre, of course. It has all the ingredients of a farce, really.
Well, a farce with some big players in it. I mean, Gérard Depardieu spent a lifetime establishing himself as a personality on and off screen. And personality seems to be playing a big role in this whole debacle, and particularly the personality of Depardieu and his relationships with François Hollande, President of France, and Vladimir Putin in Russia. John, just very quickly, Depardieu and Hollande, they really don't seem to get on, do they?
Yeah, I mean, things do seem to have got a bit personal, don't they, between Depardieu and Hollande, and especially the Prime Minister, Jean-Marc Ayrault, the one who called him assibinable, which means kind of like pathetic. Depardieu just can't stop talking about that comment. He's obviously took it very much to heart. He's attracted by leaders with a tough guy image, and well, Hollande's about far away, isn't he, from the tough guy images you can possibly get.
But still, he's stood his ground. I mean, here you have a French president who, against the backdrop of a European context in which the talk is all about austerity and cuts to welfare, he's saying, "Hang on, I'm going to go after the mega rich. They're the people that I'm going to be trying to get money from." And he's taken on Gérard Depardieu, one of the most recognisable and eccentric of French characters. I mean, Surely this has got to do something for the French president's street cred.
Yeah, well, I think Depardieu's going to winning it. Actually, I think he's winning it. He's, I think the public opinion is with him, and I think that François Hollande's tax policy looks a little bit silly, really.
So French President François Hollande seems to have come off rather worse the wear from his encounter with Gérard Depardieu.
And he's not the first one.
But I'm wondering about Vladimir Putin, Gert. What do you think that his encounter and his high-profile support of Gérard Depardieu is going to do for him in terms of his popularity?
Well, on his general popularity, it won't have such a big influence. I think many Russians, well, really like this gesture by Putin to give a passport to a well-known French actor. But well, among the people who were already against Putin, of course, this has been met with fierce criticism.
Now, finally, John in Paris and Gert in Moscow, every film has to have an end. Where do you think that this saga is going to end up? Where will Gérard Depardieu end his career? Will it be in France? Will it be in Russia? What do you think, guys?
Well, I'd be worried that it's going to end rather sooner than anyone would have liked, because I think one of the things we've not talked about is the state of Gérard Depardieu's health. Many people who are close to him are worried that he's just not going to be able to hold out that much longer, and you know, he could go out quite quickly in a very large box.
Oh dear, Gert, it sounds like we should have been talking to you about the state of the Russian healthcare service and not its tax system.
Yeah, well, maybe he's well aware of the state of the Russian healthcare system, but at any rate, I think there's hardly anybody who is really expecting Depardieu to go and live in Russia.
It's very difficult to know where he's going to end up. I think this is a very good question. I mean, he's bought a horrible house in Belgium. He's not going to live there. He's not going to live in Russia. Krebs, right? He's burned his bridges in France, hasn't he? I mean, he's handed in his French passport. He's had this big blistering row with the French government. He can't really come back here with his tail between his legs. So what's he going to do? Very good question. I don't know. London, New York?
Well, wherever he ends up, his films, or at least some of them, are likely to live on. So thank you very much for talking to me, John Laurenson in Paris and Gert Rotkoekamp in Moscow. Well, Gérard Depardieu has certainly transformed himself into a Russian citizen, but there seems very little doubt that he is still very much the same irrevocably French character. For some people, transforming yourself and being true to yourself go hand in hand. That's certainly the case in the next two stories we're about to hear. The first story is about Iran and Israel. However, you won't hear the words nuclear or attack or missile or war. That's because it's a story about crossing borders, geographical, cultural, religious, musical. Zach Rosen brings us this profile of one man's journey from one place to another.
When he was in grade school, Ayal Saeed Mani remembers being woken at 7 a.m. by the sound of music. It was coming from his living room. This was the late 1960s in Iran. Mani's dad, a Sufi Muslim, made his living as a journalist, but his true passion was playing ancient Persian music.
He never performed, not in radio, not in television, not in public. He was at home.
Even though he didn't play in public or release albums, Mani's father was known by the top musicians in Tehran as a true master. And they would regularly come over to his house to practice scales.
In a few minutes, they would ride on the scales and on the playing with the instruments. So just jamming the most hardcore that can be.
Mani wanted to jam too, but by 8 o'clock, his mother was pushing him out the door to get to school.
And I used to forget some of my notebooks and books, and I used to forget to eat, but I had to go.
The sounds hypnotized him, and before long, Mani was learning Persian music at home and Western classical music in a conservatory. Today, he can't even keep track of how many instruments he can play.
What does it matter?
By the time he was 16, Mani had plans to earn a PhD at a conservatory in Vienna. But before he had a chance to take off, his mother invited him on a trip to Israel.
The relation between Israel and Iran were very good in the 70s.
She had cancer and was seeking treatment in Israel.
When I was supposed to go to Vienna, my mother told me, maybe you come with me for a month in Israel to help me, and then you continue to Vienna. And on the airplane, on the flight to Israel, she told me she was Jewish.
Mani and his sisters were raised Muslim. They read the Quran, they ate halal meat, never having any idea they were half Jewish. It was a secret their parents didn't let them in on.
My father was a very, very special person, a Sufi and a Muslim. but the surrounding was hostile and it was not easy.
So when Manny's mom finally broke down and told him that he was actually part Jewish...
I told her, so what does it mean? And she told me, listen, Jewish go by the mother.
By this he means, if your mom's Jewish, you're Jewish.
And I said, what do I care? I go by the father, I'm Muslim.
Then Manny arrived in Israel and says he stepped off the plane and fell deeply in love with the place.
So when I came to Israel, I fell in love. Fell in love with the air. Fell in love with the place, with the variation of the place. I was a wow, a huge wow. Very quickly, I got mixed with musicians in Israel. And I found myself connected only to Israel. I had no will to go back to Persia.
For the next 10 or so years, he pieced together a living as a musician in a city called Hulon, just outside of Tel Aviv. And at the same time, he began learning about Judaism.
I had friends that used to take me to make a kiddush, like to pray on Saturday, but we used to drive there and then go to the beach. So it was all mixed up. And I thought, this is true, this religion.
But it really wasn't until he was 28 that Manny became observant. At that point, he stopped driving on the Sabbath and started studying Torah at yeshiva. For the next 20 years, he dove so deeply into Judaism that he barely played any music at all. He grew a long white beard and began wearing black suits and hats. The community started calling him Rabbi Manny. And finally, when he was 48, it was actually his own rabbi who encouraged him to ease up a bit on the Torah and get back into music.
I'm studying Torah and I'm teaching Torah as well, and the rabbis told me cut off many of my obligations that I can find more time to the music.
Now Manny splits his time between music and Torah study. He's built a recording studio in the back of an old industrial building, and he's put together a 6-person ensemble. Some of the guys in the band are Orthodox, like Manny, others are kind of somewhere in the middle, and some aren't religious at all.
Most of the world's politicians and media wants to show that there is a real separation in the world between humans. It doesn't really exist. There is unity, there is love, and this is a mission to show it, that it does exist.
Aviv Kaminer first approached Manny as a student. Now they're bandmates. He's the guy that's been translating for me.
I came to Persian music because I fell in love with it, and it's very mystical for me.
And what's happened when you've met people from Iran that have discovered that you play their music? How do they react?
First of all, it was a shock for me that all of them were so friendly to me. Unbelievable. So friendly.
Kaminer met several young Iranians when he was studying music in Holland.
It's people with such a high culture, Iranian people and manners. They couldn't believe why I loved their music. And when I told them, they were so happy and interested about what's going on in Israel.
Though the band is in its infancy, they've begun playing at different festivals around Israel. They practice all the time and are excited to keep playing music for anyone who wants to listen.
I don't know who said it in the tradition of Judaism, but it is known that one way of defeating your enemies is playing their music to them. And the real idea of it is to know their culture, to know their language, to know what they use. And when they hear it, they get so excited that you know their culture and they kind of melting. And you defeat them by love, actually.
Zach Rosen crossing cultural borders in the company of Eyal Manny. And, like Eyal Manny, the person in our next story found that, in order to be true to herself, she had to make a few changes. Or rather, one big change. The Reverend Sarah Jones was, you see, born a boy. Only, that just didn't feel right. Ashley Byrne has the story of Britain's first transgender female priest.
So we're here in St Mary's Churchyard, and as you look out you can see all the tombstones from previous generations and our church hall across the churchyard there.
Sarah is showing us around the grounds of a 13th century church in Ross-on-Wye, a picturesque market town in the rolling Herefordshire countryside in the west of England.
So we're in the porch now and we're just about to go through the big old doors. And into St Mary's Church.
Sarah is a rector here, and her proper title is Reverend, the Reverend Sarah Jones.
Blessed are you, Sovereign God, creator of heaven and earth.
Becoming a vicar was the realisation of a lifetime's ambition for Sarah, but reaching that goal has been far from easy.
May the light of your love be born in us to fill our hearts.
The Church of England has been ordaining women priests since 1994, but Sarah is unusual in that she actually started her life as a boy.
I always felt a little weird, to be honest. I never felt like a real boy. And I always knew, well, probably from sort of 5 or 6, that something wasn't quite right. So, I mean, I wasn't sort of totally friendless or anything, but I was never particularly popular in school. And I think a lot of the kids knew I was odd, although none of us knew quite why.
Running alongside the anxiety about who she really was her religious upbringing.
Well, the strange thing was, even as a child of 7 or 8, I thought I wanted to be a priest.
Sarah didn't go to university on leaving school and decided to turn to education later in life. And it was at that point in her late 20s that she also made a major decision about her gender identity too.
I'd taken about 7 or 8 or 9 years to really think it through, and I'd done everything I could not to make a gender change. I thought, I don't want to do this unless I have no options. So I'd looked at everything. I'd thought, well, maybe I'm androgynous. You know, maybe I should just be a kind of person who doesn't have a definite kind of gender. And I tried that and it didn't work for me. And I thought, well, maybe I'm a gay guy. And I tried that and it didn't really work for me. And I thought, well, maybe I'm a bit effeminate. And so I tried everything. And then when I was 28... by this time, I had had my kind of, I wouldn't call it a gender crisis, but it had like really leapt on me, and I had realised I needed to do something about it. So I quit work. I moved to Sheffield, which is a great city, and I bounced around between the gender lines, and I went back to school with 16-year-olds. So then, although I was living in Sheffield, but my grades were good enough, fortunately, that one of my teachers said to me, well, you could apply to go to Oxford. And so I did, and they took me. And what I did was, I was 30 when I finished my A-levels, and I thought, well, it's now or never. So the day after my last A-level, I packed up my old clothes, my male clothes, if you like, and I thought, I've got about 2.5 months before university. So I thought, well, I will change and see if it works, and if it doesn't work, then I'll have to go to university as a guy. And if it works, then I'll go as a woman. So I had to ring up Oxford and tell them, actually, I'd made a bit of a change.
Sarah still really wanted to be a priest, but was unsure how the church would react to her having gender realignment surgery, and whether she herself felt it was right in the eyes of God.
In the end, I thought, well, look, if I can be a better person and a more whole person by making a gender change, that has surely got to be better in God's eyes than being a sort of damaged, maybe repressed, unhappy, guilty guy when I wasn't one.
So Sarah had made the leap, and when she applied to become a priest, she was supported by senior members of the local diocese, including her bishop.
The nations shall see your deliverance, and all rulers shall see your glory.
Having reconciled her gender identity with herself and with her faith, Sarah started to settle into her new role in Ross-on-Wye. But within a few months of becoming the parish priest, the British tabloid press was on her back.
I got a phone call one day. I'd been in the post about 5-6 months. I got a phone call one day from a national newspaper saying that they had the story, that I had been outed by someone who had rung them more than once and was encouraging them to run with the story. And everyone in the town knew. They'd been reading in the newspapers. It was on the television. And I walked into a shop, and everybody, wherever I went, they just went quiet because they didn't know what to say. I mean, I was in every newspaper, and I hit on the line of saying, so how's your week been? And everyone would fall about laughing, and it kind of broke the ice, really.
Undaunted, Sarah continues to serve her parishioners and even finds time for a parallel career.
Now you look good, I have to say. You like a dream when you came my way. Some time back. Turn bad, you're bad.
The Reverend Sarah Jones's story was produced and presented by Ashley Byrne. Now, I did promise, it's time for the £1 fishman. His real name is Shahid Nazir, and when he arrived in London from his native Pakistan a year ago, he can hardly have imagined where his life would lead him. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
Not the most auspicious launch pad for a show business career, but it was at this market in East London that fish vendor Shahid Nazir began his meteoric rise. His boss told him to shout his sales pitch. He decided to sing it instead.
Come on ladies, £1 fish, come on ladies.
Everyone said, your song is so catchy, your voice is very good, you should be a pop star.
Did it help you sell a lot of fish?
Yes, the people love this song, even though some customers said, if you don't sing the song, we will not buy the fish.
Very, very good and very, very cheap. Come on, ladies, come on, £1 fish.
One of those customers filmed Shahid on his smartphone and uploaded the video to YouTube. 4.5 million hits later, the fish vendor is wallowing in global celebrity.
I never thought about this. One day I will become famous.
Now he has a manager, a record deal, and a following.
You can follow me on my Twitter. My Twitter is @real1poundfish. So you can follow me.
How many followers do you have?
28,000 people now follow me on the Twitter. So the Twitter is going mad after this happened. Come on, ladies, come on, ladies.
Eager to cash in, Warner Music signed up Shahid, remixed his vocals with a Bhangra backing track, and shot a video of him shimmying with scantily clad Bollywood dancers and brandishing a fish. Warner's Anton Partridge produced the single.
I would hope to be able to at least break the top 40, and then from there, that's where we start seeing where the record will go.
In the event, he made number 29. Not bad for a first attempt. But what are the chances of a successful follow-up? Doesn't Shahid bear all the hallmarks of a one-hit wonder?
More than likely. Unless he changes market stalls and finds something new to sing about.
And that's his record producer speaking. Music critic Mark Sutherland is even less encouraging.
I think if I was him, I'd probably keep the day job on for a while yet, just to make sure he's going to be a rock star before giving it all up for the sake of one single. You know, the music business sadly is a precarious place, so. You know, I think he might want to stick with the fish for a little bit yet.
But even that's going to be tricky. Shahid's internet celebrity brought him to the attention of Britain's immigration authorities. They noted that Shahid had entered the UK on a student visa. So what was he doing selling fish down the market, let alone trying to break into show business? On the orders of the UK Border Agency, Shahid has now returned to his native Pakistan.
Good afternoon, Migration Watch.
And here at the London office of Migration Watch, an immigration watchdog, staff say the story of the £1 fish man looks all too familiar. Matthew Pollard says for tens of thousands of would-be immigrants, a student visa is a back door into Britain.
There's been 90,000 notifications of students dropping out or just failing to attend courses. So what we're certain of, the student route has been a major source of abuse.
Although given Shahid's online popularity in Britain, Matthew is quick to stress he has nothing personal against the £1 fish man.
Good luck to that guy. I've no issues at all with someone trying to better themselves. This is just a public policy issue about the scale of migration. For the individual, wish them the best of luck.
Back in Pakistan, Shahid got a hero's reception. He says he'll now apply for a working visa in Britain. Now that he's tasted fame, he's determined to continue down the path to stardom. Before he left for Pakistan, I met Shahid in his manager's office, in a room above a halal butcher's shop next to the market. He was bullish and already trying to expand and diversify his repertoire. He's writing a new song.
It's not about fish.
It's about beauty, about a dream girl. I'm watching your face, I'm watching you, you are so beautiful.
That's all well and good, but in a world that demands something different, can another song about a beautiful girl match the novelty of one-pound fish.
Stephen Beard's telling of the rise and fall of the one-pound fishman brings us to the end of the show. WorldLink was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with thanks to Nancy Isenson and Thomas Schmidt. Don't forget that if you'd like to hear any of the items in the programme again, go to dw.de/WorldLink or look us up on iTunes. WorldLink is brought to you by DW in Bonn.